Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. For a long time, humanitarian organizations generally steered clear of politics. However, that began to change in the 1990s when a number of these groups began to argue for military interventions during humanitarian crises. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Connor Foley about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, The Thin Blue Line, How Humanitarianism Went to War. Verso is the publisher in the book. He has worked for the United Nations and for other organizations in over a dozen conflict zones, and he says now that most NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have become so compromised by their association with occupation forces that in many cases they can no longer achieve their goals. Questions, comments are certainly welcome in this part of the show. We welcome people into the conversation, only asking that they try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Connor Foley. He is a humanitarian aid worker. He has worked for a variety of human rights and humanitarian aid organizations, including Liberty, Amnesty International, and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and has spent time in a number of places, including Kosovo, Afghanistan, Colombia, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Currently, he lives and works in Brazil. He's a research fellow at the Human Rights Law Center at the University of Nottingham, and right at the moment, he's spending some time in the United States, and we're glad that he could be with us. So, again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Foley, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us. In the early part of the book here, you talk about sort of two kinds of organizations, and I guess that you have been connected with both kinds, human rights organizations and humanitarian organizations, and talk about the fact that they have different goals. Now, maybe we'll go on and talk about also your argument that, in a sense, these two organizations have been kind of drawn together. But maybe just as a way of starting, what's the distinction? What's the difference between a human rights organization and a humanitarian organization?
Yes, good question, and thanks for having me on the show. A human rights organization would tend to be an organization that monitors traditionally governments for committing violations of human rights. That might be imprisoning people wrongfully or denying people freedom of expression or torturing people or carrying out extrajudicial executions. So the sort of organizations like Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch produce reports, do advocacy work, and try to bring violations to the public's attention. A humanitarian organization like, say, the International Rescue Committee or Oxfam or CARE or Catholic Relief Service is an organization that in a humanitarian crisis, whether in a conflict or after a natural disaster like tsunami, will go into the area and distribute relief. That would be to give people medicine, food, shelter, to set up refugee camps. Traditionally, that sort of organization, which is in the middle of the crisis, won't comment on political issues. They'll just concentrate on helping the victims. And particularly in conflict zones, of course, there's a very important reason why they wouldn't want to comment on political issues, because in order to get access to the victims of the disaster, they have to show that they're neutral, that they're impartial, they're not taking sides, they're not making any conscious political comments. Mm-hmm. So you can see the two have very, very different roots and very, very different functions, although, as you said, they've been drawn together in recent years.
Yeah. And so a point I'm sure we'll come back to, but at least at this point it's worth acknowledging that you talked about the fact that perhaps humanitarian organizations would not want to make political commentary because that ends up, in a sense, drawing them into the conflict. And one of the results, I'm sure you would say, other people would say, of the kind of trend that we have seen of having humanitarian organizations actually getting into the political arguments, perhaps attaching themselves one way or another to parties to the conflict, one of the results has been that now increasingly people who work for NGOs in conflict zones have become targets.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a number of my friends and colleagues have been murdered in the last few years. And, of course, the minute aid workers are targeted, then our ability to get into those places is seriously compromised. I spent a year and a half working in Afghanistan, and I was back there twice last year, most recently in June, July of last year. And it really is very, very difficult for us to get in access to most of the country now because the security situation has deteriorated. And traditionally, aid organizations have been able to get access even during conflicts because the parties to the conflict tend to respect the neutrality. Increasingly, that's not happening. We're being identified with the occupation forces.
So you talked a little bit about the fact that there have been, and I'm sure still are, these two different kinds of organizations that had different sort of missions, but that in recent years, one of the things you argue in the book is in recent years that these two kinds of organizations have been drawn together into something that you call political humanitarianism. So define that for us.
Well, during the 1990s in particular, what happened in the big humanitarian crisis, first in northern Iraq, then in Somalia, then in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Rwanda in particular, aid workers saw massive human rights violations taking place, genocide committed in Rwanda and Srebrenica, and felt powerless and felt that they had to speak out. They couldn't. The only way they saw that people could be protected was by military intervention by the West. And so they felt that they could continue to feed people or they could continue to give them medicine, but what was the point in creating well-fed dead? And so they began to advocate for international military intervention. And a number of organizations set to one side their neutrality and said that there should be military interventions in particular crises. Kosovo of 1999 was probably the most famous of those.
Mm-hmm. To go to the question, well, why it is this happened, in part, as you say, it was no doubt due to the fact that people who were working for humanitarian, for aid organizations, they were on the ground, they were seeing what was going on, they were horrified, they were saying, look, something that we just can't stand there and watch things like this happen. Something has to happen. Something has to be done to protect people. We can't do that. So what we need to have is some kind of an international armed presence. So in part, that certainly helped. But one of the other things that you talk about, you write about in the book, is that it seemed that there at the same time, and maybe going back a little bit, there seemed to be a growing interest around the world in the cause of human rights. That is, individuals, citizens, were embracing the importance of human rights and perhaps also were putting pressure on their governments to take strong human rights positions and be involved in places where human rights were being compromised.
Exactly. I mean, I was working for Amnesty International at the end of the 1990s, and we'd gone from a position of documenting the sort of traditional human rights violations that you had in sort of in Latin America, the right-wing dictatorships in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, where dissidents were being imprisoned for speaking out. And the traditional way we'd adopt these people as prisoners of conscience, we'd get our members to write letters to the governments and say, you know, please release this person. And that sort of focus on individual violations was how the organization had grown up. But by the 1990s, we were seeing these mass violations in conflict zones. We were seeing genocidal governments unleashing huge repression on their on people, and we've also seen, you know, civil wars taking place in many parts of the world. So the human rights movement in general became more interested in mass human rights violations that accompany humanitarian crises, and so we began to advocate for intervention as the only way to protect human life and to protect human rights. So at the same time as the humanitarian organizations were beginning to move away from their neutrality and their reluctance to speak out, we as the human rights community were beginning to say there has to be a positive intervention to save people and also to bring the perpetrators of those violations to account. Part of my work, I was working in the British section of Amnesty International, And we'd been heavily involved in the campaign to what we call bring perpetrators of abuses to account. If people remember, the former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, was arrested in London for the crime of torture. At the same time, in Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic was arrested and brought to the International Criminal Tribunal for, amongst other things, the crime of genocide. An International Criminal Tribunal was set up to arrest and try the perpetrators of the genocide in Rwanda. So we, as human rights activists, were moving from simply documenting and denouncing human rights violations to calling on international action to bring the perpetrators of these violations to justice. And how I ended up going to Kosovo actually was because as the war was taking place, the Council of Europe asked me to go out and run some training sessions in the refugee camps in Albania and Macedonia to teach the activists there about the necessity to bring the war criminals to justice. So I moved from a sort of a human rights background into a humanitarian background, because of that particular specialism, the need to bring people to justice.
Hmm. Well, I can imagine that some people would say, why is it not a good thing if more people, that is, more citizens around the world, are concerned about human rights, and particularly when there are places where there are very large-scale violations, places, for example, where genocide has taken place? Isn't it a good thing if people are concerned about that and are saying to their governments and perhaps other organizations that are in a position to do something about that, isn't it a good thing if there's popular pressure for action to be taken?
Yes, which is exactly what we thought, which is why we did it, which is why we campaigned on the issues. I think the problems are two. One is a principled issue for us as people involved in human rights, people involved in humanitarian action. While we wanted to do those things, while we wanted to make a difference, we were concerned that our core business shouldn't be compromised, that we should remain independent, we should remain neutral, we should remain impartial. We shouldn't be seen as taking sides. So how we resolved the dilemma that we obviously were becoming more interventionist was we relied increasingly on international law. There's a body of international treaties and standards and resolutions and guidelines that the international community, primarily through the United Nations, has drawn up and has called for the implementation of them. So we felt that as long as we stayed within those parameters, we weren't compromising our status as independent organizations. The problem, the first problem was, were those institutions, particularly the United Nations, was that competent to implement those standards? And that came into particular sharp relief in Kosovo because the United Nations hadn't authorized their military intervention in Kosovo. And then the next problem came with Iraq with both George Bush and Tony Blair saying that the United Nations should no longer have the sole discretion to say when force should be authorized. And so I think that created the big practical problem. First, there was the 9/11 attack. And the U.S. Military response to that, which was, it wasn't humanitarian intervention. They were responding to an armed attack by al-Qaeda based in Afghanistan on U.S. citizens. And under international law, that's a legitimate thing for them to do. The nations have the right to self-defense, and the intervention in Afghanistan was approved by the United Nations. But then the invasion of Iraq, which couldn't be justified on self-defense and wasn't authorized by the United Nations, so was illegal from the perspective of international law, posed us with a dilemma. Should we be involved in that? There was clearly suffering on the ground in Iraq, but should we go in there alongside the international forces who became an occupation? Should we be in there in Afghanistan alongside international forces who have become an occupation? And what would that do to our impartiality, our credibility? And not just a question of physical safety, although, our lives are important, but the question of access. Can we continue to be humanitarians when we become so closely linked to the occupation forces?
We are talking this morning, in this part of Focus 580, with Connor Foley. He's worked for a variety of human rights and humanitarian aid organizations, among them Amnesty International and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. He's worked in a number of places around the world, including Kosovo, Afghanistan, Colombia, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. And he is the author of the book, The Thin Blue Line, How Humanitarianism Went to War. Verso is the publisher. He's spending some time now in the United States. He makes his home in South America, in Brazil. He is also attached to the faculty. He is a research fellow at the Human Rights Law Center at University of Nottingham in the UK, and he currently lives and works in Brazil and is spending some time in the United States and is talking with us here by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you talk about in the book, and I'm interested in having you talk about, is the fact that perhaps for some humanitarian and human rights organizations, the fact that there has been this growing sort of interest among people around the world in working on these issues and wanting to support the work of groups like Amnesty International or CARE or Oxfam or whatever, is that people have been giving those organizations their support and been sending them money, and that's certainly been good for those organizations. I'm sure that obviously they need money to do their work, but you seem to make the argument that there may be some downside to an organization getting a lot of attention, having a lot of support, having a lot of membership, and having people send money.
I think we've moved in the last 10 to 20 years from being very under-resourced voluntarist organizations, primarily dependent on volunteers to do our work, to becoming more professional. I mean, the budgets of all of the organizations you mentioned have increased dramatically in that time period. And, you know, we're now an industry. Several billion dollars a year is spent by both UN and non-governmental organizations on humanitarian relief. We employ tens of thousands of professional staff. And I think because of that, we deserve more scrutiny. When we were the assumption that we are just doing good and therefore should be allowed to get on with it, I don't think stands up anymore. The public has a right to know both what we're doing with their money, which they give to us, but also what we're doing with taxpayers' money. Most humanitarian organizations get public money from their public appeals, but they also get large amounts of money from governments and from intergovernmental organizations, which is ultimately funded by taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So I think that the public have a right to ask what we're doing with it, hold us to account for it, ask are we doing good with it, and criticize us if we're not measuring up to the mark.
Well, and I certainly don't want to suggest that organizations like this are squandering their resources, and certainly would not want to say anything that would discourage people from contributing to such an organization if that's what they want to do. But do you think that it is the case that there are times when resources are not well used?
Undoubtedly, yes. Again, I mean, having worked for a variety of organizations, I don't think there's a problem of lack of commitment or corruption or conscious misuse. But sometimes it's just inevitable. I mean, after tsunami, for example, there was such a huge outpouring of public sympathy for the victims of that disaster, which took place in a number of countries where lots of people go on holiday. So that when the disaster happened just after Christmas of 2004, lots of people were actually on holiday. I had friends in many of the places that were affected by the tsunami, so we were all immediately focused on what was happening. And as soon as the first instinct was to give money to whoever we thought could help. The problem with a disaster like tsunami is to scale up. It's very difficult to scale up very, very quickly. I mean, that happened in the course of a few days. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Millions of people were driven out of their homes. It was Christmas, so most people were on holiday at the time. Well, most staff of the relevant organization were on holiday. I remember I was on my honeymoon at the time. I'd just got married and got this phone call from my organisation in Oslo saying, how quickly can you get to Sri Lanka? So there was a sort of scramble to be there, to be seen to be doing something, to justify fundraising appeals. And maybe we didn't spend the money as well as we could have done. Certainly far more money came in than we were capable of spending in the time period that was demanded of us. And I think that's a kind of a general problem that humanitarian organisations have. The public want to see us helping people. The public are prepared to give us money to help people. We want to help people. We want to get the money. But sometimes we therefore promise that we can do more than is actually possible. And that means that we can end up with a large amount of money that we simply can't spend within the time period available. The flip side of that is that because the public are slightly sceptical of us because they hear the stories of aid not going to the right people, so they try to put more and more conditions on how we spend the money. They say, well, we only want the money spent on children in this area, or we only want the money spent on building these houses in this place. But often on the ground, that's actually quite difficult because you can't get permission from the government to build shelters in a particular area, or because another organisation has already gone and built the school that you've promised your supporters you're going to go and build. So I think there's a lot of jostling where organisations are trying to spend money. The public are suspicious of the way the money's been spent. I don't think we spend enough time listening to the recipients and asking the people who we've come to help, well, what would you like us to do? How would you like us to spend this? How do you think we could help you to help yourself? So I think there's a need for a reorientation in which we spend less time focused on the fundraising and accounting to our donors about what we're doing, and more time talking to and listening to the people that we've gone to help in the first place. And I think that's going to require quite a big mind shift on the part of a lot of organizations.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into our conversation. The caller is in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, another great topic. I'm wanting to focus more on, ask you to focus more for at least a moment on the idea of the manipulation by governments to using the ruse or the authentic, you know, problem of humanitarian disasters to have their way and change their policies. I mean, I guess the Iraq War is sort of a no-brainer example, but it's influenced a lot by Chomsky's books, particularly the one Lessons from Kosovo. I forget the subtitle, something about military humanitarianism. Mm. I can't pull anything directly out. It's been a long time since I read it, but you know, the way that Holbrooke crafted the Rambouillet Accord to be totally unacceptable seemed to me just a way for them to, you know, get their war on, as it were. And it's a complicated situation, and I don't want that to be the, anyway, reflect Chomsky's major analysis, but it's the one that comes to mind. And it seems to me that you know, you can go into the history of the British Empire and find all sorts of interventions that were claimed to be humanitarian, and they certainly weren't. So it just seems to me that that's part of the problem. I mean, we've gotten to this surreal occasion where I guess a student group collecting money actually made overtures to Blackwater to intervene in Sudan, and completely not realizing that they were training, Blackwater was hired by someone, and it was probably a U.S. government cutout, to train people in the South to fuel the ongoing insurrection and, you know, legitimate rebellion in some regards in South Sudan. So, you know, not an appropriate player in any regard, if that is a reasonable strategy to begin with. I'd like your reflections.
Yeah, a very good series of questions. I think Kosovo is a very interesting point. I mean, having my views about what was happening in Kosovo before I went and after going there changed dramatically. And I think there was an awful lot of propaganda put out by the West about Kosovo to justify that intervention. I think there's a broad problem which we as humanitarians face, and as human rights activists face, is that conflicts take place within a certain political context. You know, it doesn't just happen that people are suddenly evil and nasty. And so if you're a human rights organization or if you're a humanitarian organization, you focus on the suffering of the people caught up in the conflict. But you always have to remember that there's a political basis to that conflict. And I think one of the problems of what I refer to as political humanitarianism is that it glosses over that. So there's a tendency by focusing on the suffering of civilians to portray things as pure, you know, black and white, good and evil. So in Rwanda, there was the genocidas and the drawn from the Hutu population and the Tutsis who were the primary victims. But we forget that the Rwandan Popular Front, the guerrilla organization of the Tutsis, was also complicit in carrying out large-scale human rights violations. When we look at Kosovo, clearly the Yugoslav army and Serbian paramilitaries carried out huge violations of human rights and humanitarian law, but so did the terrorists of the Kosovo Liberation Army, the Albanians. And again, in Sudan, we saw the genocide that's taken place in Darfur, and the focus on the Janjaweed and the government forces. The president of Sudan has now been indicted for genocide. But again, rebel forces were also carrying out widespread atrocities. And I think quite often, humanitarians and the general public who want to support humanitarians and support humanitarian interventions see it in very black and white, Manichaean terms. And, of course, the conflicts aren't like that. And I think Kosovo was probably the best example of Western leaders making a decision that they were going to form military intervention. And I think the reason why they decided in favor of military intervention was partly out of some guilt for what had happened in Srebrenica, partly out of a feeling that NATO had been humiliated by the Yugoslav army and Milosevic, and they wanted to make an example of Milosevic. And they then massively simplified the situation, and then once the conflict started, they felt committed to it. And in all wars, of course, the truth is the first casualty, and so there was a huge amount of propaganda about Kosovo and about what NATO was doing in Kosovo, which when I went there, I mean, I was very shocked to see how different the reality was. And so I think that's a big problem, and I mean, we can talk more about Iraq and Afghanistan later on, but I think where we as humanitarians find ourselves intervening in conflicts, trying to keep a focus just on the victims of the conflict, it's also important to recognize the conflict takes place within a particular circumstance.
Yes. I don't know where to go from here. There are so many nuances in all of these, but sort of this ahistoric reduction, and without looking at agendas, you know, even in, you know, maybe particularly in D.C., of what the policy. I'm still convinced, and maybe it's wrong, that the Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which is nominally a NATO base, but staffed, I think, almost fully staffed by U.S. troops, is part of the agenda. It's this whole lily pad theory of rapid deployment, and that's a very convenient place to have a base. And I'm not reducing it to that, but I certainly think that for a nation that has 700 bases around the world in 113 countries, that there certainly are some strategic planning people who are looking at it in that way. But I'll let you go back to the... Thank you.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in within the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'd like to introduce once again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Connor Foley. He is a humanitarian aid worker. He's worked for a variety of human rights and humanitarian aid organizations, including Amnesty International, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, has worked in a number of places, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Colombia, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Currently, he makes his home. He lives and works in Brazil. He's a research fellow at the Human Rights Law Center at the University of Nottingham in the UK. He is also the author of the book The Thin Blue Line, How Humanitarianism Went to War. Verso is the publisher on the book. It's out now. He's spending some time here in the United States, and we're pleased to have him talking with us. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about was the fact that there can be a variety of reasons that there for humanitarian crises. And you can have a natural disaster. You could have a tsunami. But you can also have a humanitarian crisis as a result of a war. So you could have vastly different situations. You could have, on the one hand, you could have the tsunami that we saw a couple of years ago, or you could have Darfur. And it seems that because those situations are so different, and because in one case there is an ongoing conflict, that it almost makes me wonder whether you either have to have a very different approach to humanitarian relief in that situation, or maybe you just have to say, maybe this is an extreme kind of position, or you just might have to say, well, as long as there's fighting going on, maybe humanitarian relief isn't possible. I mean, how do you think about that? Somebody who might put it that starkly.
Unfortunately, it's true. There will be certain circumstances where we have to say, well, we can't operate in these conditions. Medicine Sans Frontières pulled out of Afghanistan after the murder of five of their staff while I was working there. And I was discussing with them yesterday here in New York that was it the right thing to do? And they felt they were just partly a question of access and security and partly a question of principle, that they felt that their neutrality was too compromised in continuing to operate there. I was running a program in Afghanistan in 2003-2004, and it was a constant discussion I was having with my headquarters. Was, you know, do we need to suspend the program? Are we sure we can carry on operating? And I think that happens in all conflict zones, that you have to make that decision. I think the other thing is that there clearly is a distinction between a natural disaster like, say, tsunami or a drought or a flood and a conflict. One of the problems is, though, that we often find ourselves operating in what we call complex disasters, which are a combination of the two. Very often you have a famine as a result of a conflict. People can't get to their land, and that's why. So, you know, the Ethiopian famine, for example, took place in the midst of a civil war. In tsunami in both Sri Lanka and Aceh, both places I was working in, there was an ongoing conflict at the same time as there was the tsunami relief operations. I'll be going back to Sri Lanka in a couple of weeks, and it'll be interesting to see what's happening there now with the conflict between the government forces and the Tamil Tigers, hopefully coming to an end. But how you can, I mean, it's been controversial doing relief work in Sri Lanka because of that ongoing conflict. But at the same time, the aftermath of tsunami has meant that organizations are working in those places. So I think, yes, it's obviously a tension. And part of the point about being a humanitarian is that you want to be in there. You want to have access because you can see people suffering. So particularly, I think, staff on the ground are the last ones to prepare to say, no, let's get out, while their headquarters are saying, you know, we have to stop working now. And we will be saying, no, we can keep going. We have to help the people. And so there's often that tension between the two, the field worker and the headquarters.
Yeah. I guess I also wonder whether, you know, we've talked about the fact that increasingly aid workers, humanitarian aid workers, people who work for non-governmental organizations have become targets, in part because maybe some of the combatants in these conflicts see some association between the NGOs and their people and some of the other parties to the conflict. That is, they look at the NGOs and their people and say, well, you've taken a side here, So that makes you a legitimate target. I wonder also, though, whether perhaps we are increasingly seeing places where there's conflict going on and where some of the combatants in the conflict, they think that it's in their interest to promote a general atmosphere of chaos, and that anything that might be working towards order and stability, like an organization that would be trying to help people and pass out food and give medicine and just try to get things settled down, that somebody who is doing that would end up being a natural target if what you really want is to have things continually to be in an upheaval.
Yes, that's certainly a problem, although it can operate both ways. I mean, one of the things that happens quite often in conflicts is the aid is looted. So various militias actually like the fact that there's aid organizations operating in the conflict zone because it's a source of supplies for them. And then there's the issue, well, should we pull out because we are helping to fuel the war economy, or should we use... what extent is it legitimate for us to use our bargaining power to stay, saying, well, if you attack us, we won't, we'll pull out, which gives us some kind of leverage. So there's a sort of the criminal element to a conflict, because crime always increases alongside a conflict. And then there's the point with, in Afghanistan, certainly when I was working there, various organizations did see attacking aid workers as a way of delegitimizing the authority of the central government in Kabul. And I've seen the same in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where the militias saw the aid workers as the most visible sign of the only sort of stability or order there was. So we became targets in that sense. And that's kind of quite difficult, because on the one hand, clearly we have a vested interest in law and order and in justice and in some kind of there being some kind of authority that enables us to operate, and that will obviously be a benefit to the people we've come to help. But then we find ourselves sometimes caught up in the geopolitics of other states. And the previous caller mentioned why the U.S. wanted to go into Kosovo, and did they go in to set up a military base, Bombsteel, which I don't know the answer to that. And I don't know the answer to, but I do know the answer to why they went into Afghanistan, but I don't really know the answer to why they went into Iraq. But there certainly was a problem with aid organizations working alongside U.S. military forces in both Afghanistan and Iraq, because we are seen as being part of an agenda which the insurgency as the occupation. And I think that's the reason why this has turned from a sort of a theoretical discussion into such a massive political discussion, is because of the invasion of Iraq, that both George Bush and, to a greater extent, Tony Blair portrayed Iraq as some kind of humanitarian intervention. And so it's not surprising that lots of people associate that, which, I mean, it wasn't a humanitarian intervention, but it's not surprising that people shouldn't take them at their word and say, well, in that case, the humanitarians are part of the occupation forces, so are legitimate.
Well, this gives me a very natural opportunity to step onto another area that I wanted to ask you about, and that is how it is that this trend that you've talked about, that perhaps this coming together of human rights organizations and humanitarian organizations, growing interest among people around the world in the issue of human rights, and growing attention to places where there were very large, where it was seen to be very large-scale violation of human rights, how all of this has helped to shape what in the minds of the public constitutes a humanitarian disaster, and whether in fact that has over time there has been a change in what people think qualifies as humanitarian disaster.
Yes, it's a dilemma. And partly, if you're a humanitarian organization and you want people to care about suffering, then, you know, just as a journalist will present things in the most dramatic terms, humanitarian organizations will themselves, you know, warn people, there is a disaster brewing here, you have to care, you have to focus. I mean, that's how organizations fundraise. So we have very dramatic images, very dramatic reports highlighting particular crises and encouraging people to give money, to take political action. And I think that can sometimes lead to a problem. Sometimes we have a vested interest in dramatizing crisis beyond which we shouldn't, where sort of an ongoing crisis that might, 10, 15 years ago have just gone ignored is now being highlighted and public attention is being drawn to it, which leads to calls for intervention. The previous caller highlighted the situation in Darfur with student groups setting up campaigns to call for a military intervention in Darfur. And clearly the situation in Darfur was terrible. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people died, mainly through illness and hunger, but certainly tens of thousands died through violence. And there was a big campaign through church groups and activists. I mean, the cast of ER were dramatizing what was happening in Darfur. But sometimes that actually can be unhelpful. I mean, I knew a lot of people who were working in Darfur at the time of the crisis at its highest, and they were saying, well, actually, some of this is gone beyond simply calling attention to it. Some of this is just propaganda, and they were wondering why people were using inflated death tolls and so on. So I think that definitely can be a problem.
Hmm. Well, if you have a situation where there is an ongoing conflict and a government or governments, perhaps for their own political agendas, decide to intervene and decide as a way of building support to emphasize the humanitarian dimensions of this, and that there truly are humanitarian, that is, in a sense, there's humanitarian disaster goes on, that's part of the thing. And if you're an organization whose mission it is to address humanitarian disaster, well, then what do you do? Do you say, well, because this is what we do, we're going to go in at the risk that we're going to be seen to be taking a side in this conflict or allying ourselves with military occupiers? Or do you say, well, because we don't want that to happen, we're not going to go, even though it's a place where someone like us is needed, and after all, that's what we do?
That's exactly the dilemma. In fact, I think you've summarized the dilemma of the book in one phrase. I remember I was offered a job in Iraq just after the invasion, and I turned it down because I had unease about exactly that situation. A lot of my friends went to Iraq. A lot of them were killed. I would have been working in the UN building when it was bombed in August 2003. And it was a big dilemma. And I have a good friend of mine who's working in Iraq at the moment. And clearly there is suffering there. Clearly, you can help people, but what price do you pay for it? And I think that the Iraq was exactly that dilemma. And the way in which the manipulation of the humanitarian arguments by Tony Blair really did bring this crisis into sharp relief and has caused a massive crisis of identity within both the human rights and the humanitarian community. Clearly Saddam Hussein was an incredibly repressive dictator who was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of his own citizens. There wasn't an ongoing humanitarian crisis at the time of the invasion, but the human rights and the humanitarian arguments were used by Bush and Blair to justify it. Should we, as humanitarians, have gone in there at the same time? I think probably most people would say no, we shouldn't have. It was a mistake to have gone in, and most of the aid organizations that did go in subsequently pulled out, often having lost staff in the process. And now we face the same dilemma in Afghanistan. President Obama is going to increase troop numbers there dramatically. Hillary Clinton has said that the western face of Afghanistan should not be the soldier, it should be the development worker, and maybe that makes sense. But from the point of view of U.S. foreign policy and also from the point of view of the Afghan people themselves, but is it right for independent, neutral humanitarian aid workers to be doing that job for the U.S. government or for the U.S., for the Afghan government? I think a lot of aid organizations are having some very serious reflection about whether or not it's our role to be in Afghanistan in the coming months and years.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Connor Foley. He's had a lot of experience working for human rights and humanitarian aid organizations, among them Amnesty International and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. If you'd like to read more on this very question that we're discussing, you can look for his book, The Thin Blue Line, How Humanitarianism Went to War. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something that maybe we can just talk a little bit about here at the end, I can give you a chance to talk about. And sadly but true, it seems to be that the record of success for humanitarian interventions just isn't very good. Most of them have not worked. And so that invites the question, well, if you can point to some places where they have worked, then what makes the difference between success and failure?
I think it's down to local people. Generally speaking, the most effective response in the aftermath of a disaster, whether that's natural or man-made, is what local people do themselves. Local people carry out their own evacuations, they rebuild their own homes, they take care of each other. Through foreign remittances, often people are from poor countries or working abroad send money home. I think the key to any intervention is to strengthen local capacity. And similarly with peace deals, you can't make the peace in a country, but there's some things you can do internationally to help consolidate peace. My background is Irish. I got involved in human rights through the Northern Ireland conflict, and we found the intervention of the American government, Bill Clinton, to be extremely helpful at a critical moment in the peace process, because the British were not trusted by neither side. I think that's really the role, but it clearly wasn't the American government's involvement that made the peace, just as it won't be the American government that makes the peace in the Middle East. You know, but you can help, and I think that's we have to be much more modest in what we actually think we can do, but realize that a little bit of aid that can help people rebuild a community, a little bit of mediation that can get the two sides talking, a little bit of external pressure to unblock certain blockages that have arisen, that can make a difference. But ultimately, it's the people themselves who have the capacity to sort out their own lives.
Well, it seems to me that that's an important idea, one you also mentioned a little bit earlier in the interview, and that strikes me has always been a kind of a bedrock idea when it comes to international development, although one that periodically seems to be forgotten, and that is you cannot come into a place and say to people, we are here to help you, and now let us tell you what we are going to do for you. And rather, the idea is that you have, if that's your intention, that you really want to try to help people, that the better way, and some people would say really the only way, is for you to go and say something like, we're here and we really want to help you, tell us what you need, and let those people set the agenda and do it on their scale and on their level, and that is likely to be much more effective and maybe even much more cost effective than the other kind of approach. It's something that we must continually remind ourselves of.
Absolutely. I mean, just to take one specific example, we often ship aid and materials all the way around the world to give to people. Here's our food, here's our blankets. Mm-hmm. Whereas it'd be much simpler just to give them money and tell them, go and buy it yourself. Allow the market to sort it out. But sometimes that's not possible. I mean, sometimes the food just simply isn't there. But it is more often than we give people credit. And if we give people the money, then they can choose what to spend it on. They might spend some of it on food and some of it on buying their kids a school uniform, for example. That's often a big thing that people want to back to school. Often we don't do it because we don't trust them. We think, if we give them money, maybe they'll spend it on the wrong things. Maybe they'll spend it on alcohol. Maybe the men will take it. We don't trust people enough. And I think that's this view view of aid as charity, as giving it to the deserving poor to do with the aid what we think they should do with it, rather than trusting them and working with them to say, you know, and if they decide at the end of it they want to have a party because they've survived a terrible tragedy, then, you know, surely that's their right to do as well. So things like a move towards cash-based programming, which is something that a lot of aid organisations are thinking about at the moment, is the sort of initiative I think we should be supporting. But I think we need to go back, we as aid organisations need to go back and explain to the public why we're doing that, because I think people in the West, very often people in the West give clothes rather than money to aid organisations because they think the aid organisations are going to waste it, and they want, you know, clothes or food as something tangible that they can give. So I think there's a whole series of perceptions, prejudices, stereotypes, cliches about the humanitarian industry that we're probably mainly responsible for perpetuating. But I think it's something that we need to explain a lot more, be a lot more involved in dialogue with, and also find much more and better ways for consulting with the people on whose behalf we say we're acting.
Well, there we will have to stop. Again, our guest, Connor Foley, has worked for a number of human rights and humanitarian aid organizations, among them Liberty, Amnesty International, and the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. He's a research fellow at the Human Rights Law Center at the University of Nottingham. He's now making his home. He's living and working in Brazil, but he's spending some time in the United States and was talking with us this morning about some of the ideas that you'll find in his book, The Thin Blue Line, the subtitle, How Humanitarianism Went to War. Verso is the publisher. And Connor Foley, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.